Over, which is now being hosted by Jason Bradford up in our Willits studio. And away we go.
Hi, this is The Party's Over Going Local with your host Jason Bradford and engineer Tim Gregory. This show was originated with Els Cooperwriter. I want to thank Els for trusting me with her baby. And we're going to have a great show. Our guest is Stuart Staniford of theoildrum.com. But first, I want to talk about some underwriters and then do community announcements. So this show is brought to you in part by our members and Graces on Main, located at 323 North Main in Ukiah, providers of Hoyman Brow Pottery, contemporary natural fiber clothing, jewelry, and accessories, gift certificates and gift wrapping, too, open 7 days a week in December. And also brought to you by Black Bear Press, offering printing services since 1978, from business cards to four-color brochures. Also, high-resolution digital image setting and custom graphic design. That's Black Bear Press, 964-8465. So I want to remind everybody that we are in the Willits studio, and that number is 456-9991. So give us a call if you've got some community announcements. The phones are waiting. Here we go, first call. You're on the air. Hello, caller. Can you hear me?
You got me. Let me turn this radio down. Hi, this is Robert here from west of where you are.
Hi, Robert. What do you have?
I just want to congratulate you for taking on the show and for doing it from our remote studio. I'm really proud of you.
Thank you.
I know how brave it is to be in there. Anyway, I just want to announce again our English Country Dance over at the Casper Community Center on Saturday. Starts at 8, show up 15 minutes early for instruction if you've never done it before. And it's kind of like square dance or contra dance. It's a little more elegant. The music is older. It's mostly Baroque music. It sounds a lot like most of our favorite Christmas carols. It comes from the same historical period that most of them come from.
That's great. The party's not over in Casper.
The party is not quite over there.
That's fantastic.
So anyway, it's lots and lots of fun. Bring a few nickels and dimes help us pay for the hall. There will be snacks and so on, and it's wonderful fun.
Okay, so what's the date again?
So that's this Saturday.
Saturday.
The 10th, and it starts at 8, but get there 15 minutes early if you've never done it before, and they'll teach you what the terms are. It's a called dance, and they'll tell you what to do and when, but it's so much fun, and it's just a very nice, jolly holiday kind of thing to do. So come and have fun with us.
All right, 8 p.m. in Casper. Thanks a lot, Robert.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, 456-9991 is the number in the Willits studio. And I'm going to announce that Willits Economic Localization has a meeting tonight in the community center at 6:30 p.m., and it's a general meeting of the working groups of WELL. So come on down and join the economic localization movement here in Mendocino County. Do we have any more calls? 456-9991. I heard some great things about the CEL, an Alliance for Democracy, I guess, event in Fort Bragg. They had apparently 200-plus people, and I just congratulate them for having a great event on sort of energy issues, energy independence, local control of energy. I guess Don Dame and Steve Heckroth were there. They've both spoken in Willits, so I know those are really knowledgeable people. So 456-9991, we have any more calls? If not, we're going to go to our guests. Okay, why don't we just put on some music, and I'll give our guests a call.
Turn out the lights, the party's over. They say that all good things must end. Let's call it a night. The party's over, and tomorrow'll start the same old thing again. What a crazy, crazy party. Never seen so many people laughing, dancing. Look at you, you're having fun. But look at me, I'm almost crying. But that don't keep her love from dying. Misery calls for me, the party's over. Turn out the lights, the party's over. They say that all good things must end. Let's call it a night.
Okay, thank you. Stuart, can you hear me all right?
Yes.
Excellent. Well, welcome to The Party's Over, Going Local. Stuart, you're in San Francisco, but you're not from there. Can you tell us where you originate?
I'm originally English.
All right.
I grew up in the northwest of England, but I came here about 17 years ago now.
All right, so you have a doctorate in physics and have worked in the computer industry, and can you fill us in on some more details about that?
When I was young, I was sort of trying to do whatever seemed hardest to me. And so I went into theoretical physics and got a PhD in it. And I was working on the early universe and, elementary particle physics and how these particles changed, went through a phase transition in the early universe.
Wow.
And at some point I realized that, it was all very abstract and I wasn't that passionate about it. And, of course, physics is an incredibly competitive field, right, where all these super smart people want to do it. And so it's very hard to, get a position. You can sort of more or less only do research in that field. So I decided it made more sense to quit, and I got a master's in computer science overlapping the end of my PhD. And it turned out UC Davis, where I was studying, had a very strong group in computer intrusion detection. So I got into that field at kind of a nice time and have spent the last decade doing a mixture of sort of research and then increasingly some product development in that area.
Well, so you were able to change gears, it sounds like, pretty quickly, and it seems like you've done that also recently with this peak oil issue.
Yeah.
what's the story about how you learned about peak oil and why you came to regard the issue as really serious and deserving of your rapt attention? Because I've been following what you've been doing, and I can tell you're just going at it and really understanding this really clearly right now.
Well, so, it's basically a retirement planning project that went horribly wrong, right? I'm a father of two young boys, and so I was doing that sort of exercise where you figure out, how on earth am I going to manage, funding these guys going to college in 15, 20 years and my wife for my retirement and all this. And, so you sort of say, well, if we save this much and the stock market grows by that much, then, everything will be fine.
Right.
And I started to look at that long-term growth rate in the stock market and think, well, what assumptions are we making here when we're planning for 2040? And how valid might those assumptions be? So I started researching it on the internet. And, I sort of looked into the climate change thing, and that was bad, but not cataclysmically bad in the short term. I've come to see that as somewhat worse than I used to, but still.
Mm-hmm.
But then I discovered this report called the Hirsch Report, which came out of... it was done by some folks working at SAIC, which is a big, big government research contractor, and was funded by the Department of Energy. And it was a very scary report, essentially saying, there's all these experts that say our oil production will peak, and they disagree about the date, and we're not going to get into that debate, but we're going to look at what would society do if indeed oil peaks. And they looked at... what are the different adaptations you can make? What do we use oil for, and how would we use less? And, their essential conclusion is, look, the oil industry is so huge that anything you try to replace it with, you better start a long time ahead of time, because it's going to take you a lot of an enormous societal effort to replace this infrastructure. And, so it's quite a gloomy report. And I was particularly struck by it because I spent about 5 years running a small government contractor doing research for DARPA on computer worms, how you stop computer worms and how fast they could spread and this kind of stuff. And so I'd learned about that government contracting work, and one of the things I knew is that if you're funded by the government, it's very hard to say anything very scurry.
Right.
You know, large government bureaucracies don't like to say controversial things. You know, it's just rocking the boat.
Mm-hmm.
And so this Hirsch report really got my attention. And as you say, I've been utterly obsessed with the subject ever since, because, you know, the more I've looked into it, the more it seems real.
Yeah, I'm really interested in the way you got into it, interested in climate change. That's how I sort of discovered it. But then also this economic growth. So you came into it thinking, okay, how am I going to, you know, save for retirement?
Uh-huh.
And so why is it then that if we have a peak oil, we're not prepared for it, that it messes up retirement plans?
Well, I've done a lot of analysis looking at the relationship between the way we use oil and economic growth. And if you look at the statistics, the Federal Highway Administration collects wonderful statistics about how far we all drive each year and even each month. And so you can plot that, and you can plot the growth of GDP. And it turns out that there's an almost lockstep correlation between the economy growing and people driving more. And presumably, I mean, I don't think I completely understand this, but presumably this is because, you know, growth basically consists of adding additional suburbs on the outside and additional industrial and commercial developments on the outside of existing cities. And so the cities, people have to drive further because the city's gotten bigger, and that's the process of adding more capacity to the economy, more people and more houses and bigger houses and more offices and factories. And so then if you say, and at the moment, you know, transport is almost entirely powered by oil. So if you say, well, we can't have more oil each year, then the question becomes, well, what happens to that growth? And, you know, I think the answer is, as long as the decline rate in your oil production is very modest, right,
mm-hmm.
then you can sort of get a little bit more efficient each year and a little bit more efficient each year, and bad things don't happen. Or things get sort of tighter and tighter and tighter and harder to make it, but, you know, you don't have instantaneous disaster. But if that decline rate were to become very large, then it wouldn't be possible to grow the economy at all.
Yes. So the there's some people that say, oh, we're so much more efficient now in our use of oil per GDP, so we don't have to worry so much about oil. And I say to myself, no, wait a second. That means that the low-hanging fruit has been picked in our economy, and it becomes more and more difficult. And so we're even more vulnerable potentially. This is the thing. As I look at the economic analysis differently than most economists seem to.
Yeah, and I've looked into that question in a great deal of detail, and I find, because you do hear economists say that, even very eminent ones like Alan Greenspan.
Right.
And I looked into it in great detail, and I just cannot see where they're getting their conclusion from, because as you say, I mean, it's certainly true that we do use less oil per dollar of GDP than we used to in the 70s. And the change came from two things mainly. One is that we used to use oil to a much greater degree for heating and for electrical power generation. And we almost completely stopped using it for electric power generation. And we mostly stopped using it for heating. And then the other big thing that happened was we made cars more efficient. You know, in the 70s, people are driving around in big cars with, you know, cast iron V8 blocks and stuff. And so fuel efficiency, despite the SUV thing, has gotten somewhat better since then. And, you know, so those are the two largest effects. But both of them have the flavor that, you know, we're still utterly dependent on oil for all our transportation. So it's, you know,
yeah.
And as you say, now the easy low-hanging fruit of stuff has been done. And so if we have to conserve more, it will be harder.
Right. And then the heating here in the West, of course, has been dominated by natural gas.
Right, which has its own set of scurvy issues. Right,
right, right. So, you know, all these analyses you're talking about are on the oildrum.com, and I was just wanted to describe the oildraw.com to our audience, and how did you become part of that group?
So it's a blog. So it's, one of these newfangled internet-only media things. And it's pretty new from late last year. And it was started by two academics, a guy who goes by the pseudonym of Heading Out, who has actually been a faculty member in the area of energy production for many, many years. So he knows all the extraction technology really, really well. And another guy who goes by the pseudonym of Professor Goose, who's a sociologist. And they were both worried about peak oil and writing about it more and more, and they decided to combine their efforts and create this blog called The Oil Drum. And when I discovered the issue, I sort of found this website after a few months, and it was like coming home, because this was a bunch of sort of grown-up people who were intelligent and were having really thoughtful discussions about this stuff. And in particular, Heading Out obviously really, really knew his stuff. So I was reading the site and, daily as I was educating myself on this issue and coming up to speed. And then as I sort of started to get to the point where I was developing opinions and doing these analyses of all these various different factors and, deciding who I believed and who I didn't believe. And I wanted to start having somewhere to put that work in progress, as it were. And so I ended up joining them and becoming one of the editors of the site.
So why is it that you you use your real name and these professors have pseudonyms?
Well, I think it's a good question. And I think that the reasons are different for different individuals, but they all have some element of, I'm not sure that my employer would look on this with approval because this is a somewhat controversial thing. I mean, I think it's becoming less so, but it has been very controversial.
Right.
And, so for example, I mean, an obvious case, one of our contributors who goes by the name of Bubba, he has worked in oil companies for 20 years. And his job is to evaluate prospects that his particular oil company is considering worldwide. I mean, it's one of the major oil companies. And, so he's out there expressing his opinion about, hey, I'm not seeing a whole lot of oil here.
Right.
And, but that's not something that his employer wants to say in those words. So he obviously has to say that anonymously. And then I think for the academics, several of our editors are younger and don't have tenure yet, right? So they're concerned about not wanting to be seen to be, especially if they're dabbling somewhat outside of their area. If you're a sociologist, is peak oil, a legitimate inquiry for sociologists yet?
Right. That's a really good point. I had the same kind of reaction when I was talking about it to colleagues in academia as a biologist.
Uh-huh.
What are you talking about this for?
Yeah, so it's right.
Here's your territory. Here's your box you're supposed to be in. And
yeah, I mean, our society is so complex that people are very, very specialized. And that
right.
is reflected in academia, too.
And wait a second. You're a physicist that studied computer science. What are you doing,
Right. Yeah. Right. And I have lived a somewhat unconventional career, and I've been fortunate enough to get away with that. I make my living as a consultant for various companies. Mm-hmm. On the computer security issues that I'm an expert in. And I really struggled with the question of, do I want to use my own name talking about this stuff? And I finally decided that I would, and I would just, take the consequences, whatever they may be.
My view of it sort of been, what have we got to lose now if things are really as bad as some people think?
right, there is that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and maybe there'll be some upside too, because people, as these issues start to unfold, people that really understand them, will be of value, and so.
Right. So, this is what attracts me to the oil drum is what attracted you, I guess, is the actual numerical analysis of data, rather than just quoting competing experts. And
right,
I get really frustrated reading most news accounts. So, you know, you consider the Old Drum to be different than most mainstream media sources. And how and why is it so different?
Well, yeah, I have the same reaction that you do. That I mean, I went through the whole energy crisis in California a few years back. And I read the newspaper every day. And I realize now that I never understood that issue much at all. I feel like if you really want to understand something, you cannot understand it from the newspaper, you know, because you basically get all these stories that are sort of he said, she said,
right,
about some controversy. And there's nothing quantitative in it. There's nothing, you know, it's all written for story, right? It's actually this really nice book that I read recently called Writing for Story, which is by a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, John Franklin. And, you know, it's the art of creating a newspaper feature. And it's all about how to write an emotionally compelling story. And he says in there, you know, that when you want to actually convey some facts, you need to work them into the story and make sure you don't put any superfluous ones that aren't required to just tell your story, right?
Wow.
That would distract the reader from this emotionally compelling experience that you're trying to create from them. You know, and that is great for creating entertainment, but for creating people that actually understand anything about important issues, it's not helping at all, right?
Yeah, they're trying to sell something to make money, and I guess the Oil Drum is just trying to find the truth.
Well, yeah, so the newspapers are trying to sell something for sure. They're commercial enterprises, and then I think, you know, journalists are, you know, to the extent they have some artistic pride, you know, they're creating this emotional experience that will be enjoyable for their readers, and they take some pride in that, right?
All right.
But it's not necessarily... So what you see in the blogging world is just fascinating to me, right? Because you start to get all these specialists who are out there writing every day about their particular thing. I think it's going to transform both the news media but also science over time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for example, I've been trying to learn as much as I can about the economics.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's all these blogs by economists, right? So if you want to understand some economic issue, you know, reading the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal is just not the way to do it. You can go and read what these economists are writing about it. And they'll have, you know, graphs and detailed discussion, and, you know, you can really see, well, how big is the national debt, for example? You know, how big is the budget deficit compared to GDP? You can go and look at graphs of those, which you hardly ever see in the newspaper, right? You'll see story after story after story about the deficit, but you'll never see a graph that shows you how big it is relative to the economy.
Too scary, maybe.
I don't know.
Yeah, there are some good graphs lately. I guess the LA Times had a really good graph of hurricane activity that you posted on the Oil Drum.
Yeah,
that was good.
That was great.
And you were getting a lot of attention during the hurricanes. Can maybe review your coverage on the Oil Drum? What have been some of the highlights that's in the last?
Yeah, so we really paid an enormous amount of attention to any hurricane that seemed like it was some kind of a threat to energy production. And so we had several of our contributors and editors, Professor Goose being the leading one, who were, you know, essentially obsessed with this issue of what would the hurricanes do if they hit all these oil rigs in the Gulf of Mexico and all these refineries. And so we spent a huge amount of time exploring and finding all the places on the net where you could find maps of the relevant areas and you know, projection models for where the hurricanes might go and all this kind of stuff. So we became sort of, if you really, really wanted to track what these hurricanes might do, we became a very attractive place to go, and we got a lot of attention from that.
All right. And what about the ASPO conference? Your coverage on that, was that unique, do you think?
Again, you know, because we're a somewhat specialized niche thing, right? I mean, there were a lot of media stories about the ASPO conference. That's the Association for the Study of Peak Oil, I should say.
Yes, thank you.
They held a conference in Denver a month or so back. But we, you know, we were able to go and sort of give it a lot of space and do a really extensive write-up and photos of all the speakers and et cetera, et cetera. So if you were interested in this issue, again, you know, we were the place to go.
Have you compared your coverage with other coverage, and what really stood out for you that didn't get taken care of, you think, in most reports?
Well, again, it's the same issue. You know, if you're writing for, let's say, the Denver Post, and you're going to write this one story with, you know, 12 column inches or whatever it is on this conference, and you're just not going to get into a lot of detail. You know, it's not that those reports were bad. Mm-hmm. Say, I thought the press coverage I saw was actually of the conference was fair, but but there's just not a lot of detail.
So. Right. What details did you learn? I mean, you've been following this for a long time. This is nothing new at this conference for me, or did something stand out?
Oh, no, it was absolutely fascinating. I think the two big things I came away from it with that changed my thinking were, it rather seems like the decline rate of the existing production is higher than we had previously thought, right? So this is, each year there are all these oil wells and oil fields all over the year that produce oil. And next year, the ones we have this year, will produce less oil, because oil fields just sort of decline gradually over time. And so we have to go out and drill more wells and put in more platforms to compensate for that and perhaps increase if we're prior to peak, and then becoming increasingly difficult to increase it after peak. So when you want to know, will we have more oil next year than this year, you need to know something about, well, what are all the projects that oil companies and Saudi Arabia and Venezuela are working on to create new oil? And, you know, I've been involved in, and a number of other people have been involved in, trying to tabulate all these projects. And then, but the other thing you need to know is, well, how much is the production that we have right now going to decline? And people used to sort of use an estimate of 4 or 5% for that number. But it wasn't a very well-studied number. And at the conference, I started to get exposed to people who thought the number was higher. And I sort of looked into this myself since. And with another guy, I did an analysis on Exxon, for example. And it turns out, if you look at sort of Exxon's annual reports, you can see both what they thought their growth was going to be in 2001, let's say. Mm-hmm. And then you can look at what their actual production was in subsequent years. In 2001, they thought they were going to grow at 3%, and they've actually been almost flat and then declined very slightly. And you can look at all the projects that they managed to bring on stream, the new projects to generate new oil. You know, they're off in Angola and Nigeria and so forth, bringing in new oil. And you can, and if you subtract those out and find out what was happening to the base level of production, it turns out that it's declining at 9 or 10% a year. Wow. And this is why their oil production is not growing. You know, it's because they have to replace 10% of it each year. And so that shifted my opinion. I used to think that the peak in oil production was probably still some years ago, away. And I'm now feeling like, I'm not certain yet, but I'm feeling like it's probably this year or, in the next year or two. It's quite hard to see how we can increase, in my view, quite hard to see how we can increase our oil production much more than it is now.
Yeah, so it becomes, again, you start out talking about the assumptions of economic growth for your retirement fund, and, and now you're looking at the assumptions for, you're really getting at the assumptions in these different models, because that's what's always confusing for a lot of people, I think, is this expert says this expert says that. You know, you've got Matt Simmons versus Daniel Yergin, right?
Right.
And when you start looking at their assumptions, you start to understand, I guess, why they differ.
Right. That's certainly what I've been engaged in.
Right. That's what's really impressed me.
And I think, the other thing you can do is look at people's track record.
Right.
If you look, for example, at what Matt Simmons and Daniel Yergin were saying about North American natural gas in 2000, for example, when we were putting in lots of planning to put in lots of natural gas-fired electric production, which has come on stream, you know, you had Matt Simmons really raising the alarm, saying, wait a minute, we might not be able to produce much more natural gas than we're producing now. And Jürgen saying, you know, we feel like, although there are some challenges, natural gas production can be increased at a price that will allow for us to do plenty of electricity generation with it. And, you know, and if you look at what's happened, well, Calpine's almost bankrupt, right?
Yes, yes.
From creating very large amounts of natural gas-fired electricity production and going into a lot of debt to do it. And, you know, so I think it becomes pretty clear that you would have been wise to listen to Matt Simmons and not Daniel Jürgen at that particular time. So now, of course, you know, does the past predict the future? Well, not always. But.
Right. So we're... I'm going to have station ID. This is KZYXZ, and we're talking to Stuart Staniford. This show is called The Party's Over, Going Local. Now, climate change is getting some attention now in Montreal. Have you followed any of those proceedings?
I have not been following what's going on in Montreal in detail, no.
Okay. Can you have any general recommendations for people, you know, what they should do in preparation for or response to the predicament we find ourselves in?
Well, I mean, it's very tough because there are still a lot of uncertainties. You know, I'm of the general opinion that the peak is, you know, now or not very far in the future. However, I think I sort of am a believer in a relatively soft peak. That is to say that one of the other things I learned at the conference is from this guy called Henry Groppi, who's a very astute and experienced and now quite elderly energy analyst who really impressed me, is that there's still quite a lot of this heat and power generation that we talked about earlier, where we're using oil to just make electricity, which you can do with coal or nuclear or in renewables or lots of other ways, and using it just to heat things. There's still a lot of that in the developing world. So I think now that oil prices are high, you'll see that being switched away and people using coal to do that. So that's going to buy us some time, essentially. I also think, you know, if you sort of project out the mathematics of the way oil depletion works, it looks like in the early years, decline rate on average will be relatively low. So I see peak oil as kind of more like a gradual squeeze punctuated by, you know, occasional oil shocks than, you know, I mean, there are people who you can listen to who claim that as soon as the world peaks, you know, society will instantly collapse. And I just don't agree with that at all. You know, I think you can expect to see you know, things getting gradually harder and harder to grow the economy. Gas getting slowly more and more expensive. And then, but bursty, every so often, you know, there'll be a revolution in Saudi Arabia or who knows what might happen. You know, just as there has been in the past where you had the Iraq-Iran war or the Iranian revolution, you know, that caused a sudden 10% reduction in oil supply and create a shock. I think, you know, we'll see those kinds of things, too, as the system gets more stressed. So, obviously, for your listeners, a lot of them are, you know, it's a rural area. And so I think, you know, the economy in rural areas is going to get more and more challenging.
Yeah.
Because it's been possible in the 20th century to live in a rural area in a fairly urban lifestyle, in that you can have, you know, a car or a truck or whatever and go to a store that has goods from the other side of the world. And I think that's going to slowly get tougher and tougher. And the choice between, you know, living a truly rural lifestyle with horses and growing your own food, etc., and living a, you know, a 20th century lifestyle will get, you know, that will become a more and more pressing choice that people have to make.
Yeah, I know that some of the people always worry about, you know, you have these survivalist type personalities that worry about people leaving the cities. And my sense of it initially is that the economy is going to get tougher in the rural areas before it gets tough in the cities simply because of these, you know, lack of self-sufficiency in the rural areas.
I think that's right. I think you'll see your migration going the other way, at least for a while.
This is what you see in a lot of the poorer countries that, you know, have economic crises in their countries. The rural area, the rural people migrate in
right
to the cities. And
right.
So I would like to take some phone calls, if that's all right with you.
Sure.
Okay. So, again, our studio number is 456-9991. You're on the air and the party's over.
Yeah, congratulations on the great show. I'd like to ask your guest a question.
Sure, go right ahead.
Well, whether peak oil hits softly or sharply from the point of view of one person's life, it'll really be soft, or as you say, a gradual squeeze, because, you know, it may just come across one person's lifetime. But the question is, how can we engender a change of consciousness in the common man and woman? In other words, just as much as we need good physicists and biologists, we need good math psychologists.
Right. And in a way, the fact that it might be somewhat of a gradual squeeze may make it harder for society to pay attention to it. You know, there's this famous analogy of the frog, and I don't know anyone that's ever done this experiment, but reportedly, if you throw a frog into boiling water, it will jump out. But if you put it in a pan of cold water and heat it up slowly, it will sit there and boil to death. And there is the worry that, you know, society will just very gradually accommodate to a more and more degraded environment, you know, with fewer and fewer higher quality resources and more and more strange climate. You know, and things will just get gradually worse. But never get so much worse so quickly that we all sit up and say, oh my God, you know, we need to completely change our consciousness.
Yeah, I think you underscore the question, but are there people in your travels, in your studies, have you found that there are people who are, you know, working on how to deal with this phenomenon, the phenomenon of changing consciousness?
Oh, well, there are. Suddenly,
I'm going to get off the air and let somebody else call, and you guys can answer it out. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
I certainly think there are people who are thinking about it completely from that angle. I mean, I read a book by a guy called Tom Hartman.
Yes, very good book.
Recently called Last Days of Ancient Sunlight. And he's talking about peak oil, but he's approaching it very much from his particular spiritual perspective. And, you know, so he's certainly thinking about, you know, his view is that we need a transformation in our cultural and spiritual view of the world, that we have to stop acting like, you know, the world consists of a set of material resources, and our job is to use them up as fast as possible, which is, you know, roughly the mainstream view and roughly the view of economists, mainstream economists in our culture, to something more like what hunter-gatherers would have taken the view that, you know, the world is sacred and all of it is you know, spiritual in nature, and we have to view it as sacred and use it in a sacred way. Now, I find it, you know, the gulf between that kind of viewpoint and mass culture in this country is so enormous that it's just hard for me to see how that change is going to get made unless people are just dragged kicking and screaming into it. You know?
Right. I'll take another call. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes. Though oil may peak slowly and gently, according to some theories, isn't it true that climate change, over which our control is almost zero in the short run anyway, because all of these climate change gases are up there and aren't going to disappear instantly. Even if we stop tomorrow, the chance of shocks occurring to our economy and to our, to our life from climate change are much more dangerous and iffy than the potential for slow constriction of fossil fuel availability.
That's a great question.
So with the climate change thing, I would say there's, you may be right, but there's enormous uncertainty.
Right.
Now, if you look at sort of the last IPCC report, which is there's this international group of leading experts on climate change that get together every few years and produce a big report about what they think is happening and, you know, how far it's gone and where it might go in the future. They were projecting somewhat gradual changes out over the century. And nothing really cataclysmic in the 21st century. But I think in the, you know, in the science, between the last report and now, and there's a growing realization that the climate system is not linear at all. And that from time to time in the past, it has suddenly flipped. And the most famous case is the sort of ending of the last ice age. It was very sudden. In a matter of just years, there was a substantial shift in the temperature signal that they, you know, they analyzed these things by looking at the ice cores from Greenland and Antarctica. And in particular, the Greenland ice cores are very high quality, and they can see change from year to year. And so we know that under some circumstances, the climate does change very suddenly. But I think there's a very limited understanding. So then you can construct scenarios like, you know, if Greenland starts, if the ice on Greenland starts to melt, and the polar ice cap starts to melt, which it seems like it is, then the poles absorb more sunlight. And, you know, the pole gets a lot of sunlight in the summer because it's, you know, it's day round. It gets as, in the summer, it gets as much sun as the tropics do. And so if there's less snow, then it reflects less of that sunlight and absorbs more, and so then it heats up even more. So there's a worry that there's these runaway scenarios where once you set in motion melting the pole, it can go much faster than, you know, the IPCC had been projecting. And, but I think there's enormous uncertainty about, you know, what would it take to trigger some kind of abrupt climate change, and when, and, you know, how much CO2 would be required to do that. So I think there are very large risks of very serious changes in the climate. I should say there are significant but very hard to quantify risks of serious change in the climate.
Once again, the number here in the studio is 456-9991. We've got another caller. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello, sir. I wondered if you've done any research on the Second World War and how things went on then, because we had no oil, we had no gas, we had no coffee, we had no sugar, we had no shoes, we had no clothing when the skirts got shorter and all that. And I wonder if you did any research on that, because we managed to live.
Uh-huh.
We survived.
That's a great question. Yeah. And so only a little bit is the answer. It turns out, I mentioned earlier that, you know, if you look at how far people drive,
uh-huh,
and versus the economic growth, the Second World War is a complete anomaly.
Uh-huh.
You know, entirely since the Second World War, it's always the same that, you know, more economic growth means more, uh-huh, driving. During the Second World War, that relationship was decoupled. And now the U.S. did have a lot of oil because at that time we were the world's leading oil producer.
But we were using it all over the world.
But we were using it for the war effort.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so there was rationing and,
mm-hmm, and right,
so forth.
Yeah.
And yes, it, you know, people did get by, and I think people could get by. I mean, obviously, we live a very wasteful lifestyle, and it would be possible to get by with a lot less.
Do you think Koch Industries is going to help us with oil? They just bought GP all over the United States, including the one in Fort Bragg.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with their operations.
Oh, well, they're the largest private industry in the whole United States, or larger than Cargill, and they major in petroleum products. They have all the gas lines under the United States and the oil lines.
Okay.
Okay? I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
Thank you. So, again, it's 456-9991. You know, I guess part of the problem, Stuart, as I look at it, is how do you generate investment without the anticipation of a return on that through economic growth? And I guess without, you know, without government intervention. But I think we got another call, so let's go ahead and take that. Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, hi.
I didn't think I'd get on that quick. I'm most interested in what that fellow said a couple callers back about the psychology, because that worries me the most. And I think about a statement that I heard from Rush Limbaugh when I was forced to listen to him for a while. He said that we need to drive the biggest vehicles we possibly can and use up oil and without any regard, because the scientists will come up with hydrogen. And I don't think he even understands the difference between electrochemical hydrogen and the fusion hydrogen. But it's not going to be like taking candy away from a baby. It's going to be more like from a very large spoiled brat. and I'm afraid, if you remember the Reagan years, the line went, it was sort of a conspiracy theory that there was plenty of oil out there, and Reagan exploited that, and most of the country was right behind him, and I'm afraid that that's what we'll be fighting the hardest.
You bring up a number of excellent points. One thing I just want to say on the hydrogen thing, people need to realize that hydrogen is a carrier of energy.
Right.
It is not a source of energy. You know, it is a way that you transport energy around. And some people feel that it will be better than batteries for running. You know, if you want to generate, let's say, electricity with a windmill and then use it to power your car, you know, you can charge up a lead-acid battery, but that's extremely heavy. You can get a fancy lithium-ion battery, which won't be as heavy, but will cost you an enormous amount. Or you can make hydrogen and then, you know, perhaps run the hydrogen in a fuel cell, which is a sort of, you know, it's clearly possible because Honda's built one, but it costs like $1 million. So, you know, now maybe that's just a matter of not having the scale. But I think what it draws attention to is that oil is really, really wonderful. You know, a poster on the Oil Drum the other day wrote a post sort of arguing that, roughly speaking, one barrel of oil, which is 42 gallons, corresponds to about one person year of hard manual labor.
And that energy density has created a lust that it will be hard to replace with the renewables, because the energy density doesn't seem to be there, and so it doesn't have the bells and whistles, and people
right.
just say that you're fools to.
I think that's right. And an all renewable economy would almost certainly be, you know, a significantly lower energy economy than we have.
What about educating youngsters? For instance, I've always thought that no one seems to understand the laws of thermodynamics, which aren't really complicated. You know, they can have complicated implications, but for the most part, people don't understand them to the least bit. They're always coming up with perpetual motion machines, and we need to bring that in at the third grade level, and then we wouldn't have so much of this energy loss that's undefined.
I won't presume to comment on those issues because I don't think I don't think I understand education issues very well.
Well, it's a good show. I'll leave you alone. It's a lot. Bye-bye.
All right, thanks. Do we have any more callers right now? Yes, we do. Let's go ahead and take that call. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Welcome to the airwaves. We're so glad you're doing this show. Thank you.
Oh, thank you very much.
I know you're both fond of things that are clearly quantifiable, but nonetheless, I'd like you to address that interface between the guest speaking that much of what will soften the landing is the vast resources of coal that remain, and knowing that even though technology's improved, the South Africans who have the best still say it's a pretty dirty technology, and how you see an unknown increase in the use of coal worldwide interfacing with the dynamics of climate change. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, it's a very good question. I think you are seeing strong calls now to start using a lot more coal as a way to solve the oil problem. The Chinese have signed a memorandum of understanding to put in sort of a first generation of coal to liquids technology. And just for background, this is technology that was developed in the early 20th century, and the Germans ran a significant portion of their war effort, because they were prevented by British naval blockade from getting oil, by converting their coal to to liquid fuels. And then during the apartheid era, when the South Africans were under sanctions, they did the same thing. And now, for example, I participated in a conference call with Governor Brian Schweitzer a few months back. He's the governor of Montana, which has enormous amounts of coal. The U.S. in general has the world's largest coal reserve. We have a very large amount of it. And so, you know, I think we will see people moving towards digging up a bunch of that coal, converting it to liquid fuels, and then burning it in our cars. Now, the people that want to do that are conscious of, you know, so then the problem with coal is it's got higher carbon content. And so the CO2 emission problem is even worse than with oil, and certainly than with natural gas. And so the climate implications of sort of taking this enormous amount of coal and burning it all are pretty chilling. And now they're very fond of pointing out that, you know, the CO2 that we create on site where we're doing this creation of liquid fuels, we're surely going to sequester that. But then, you know, it's the stuff that comes out the tailpipes of our cars that will be the bulk of it. And then I think they're also, you know, we're obviously going to do to a bunch more of Montana what we've done to West Virginia. And, you know, there's questions about in the dry, rocky mountain areas, do we have enough water to do this? It's a water-demanding process. You know, and water is the other great constraint of our time, I think.
Yes.
So, you know, I think there are, we can do it. I think we may well do it. It's pretty uncertain what, you know, where it's going to end if we do.
Yeah, should we do it? Next caller. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you. I've got a couple things that I haven't heard anything at all about in this group of stochastical equations on the changes of things that are happening. The first thing that I'd like to introduce to you guys, if you haven't already, how much natural gas is actually present in the continental limits of the United States, excluding Alaska, because I'm leery of pipelines going through Canada and all that. And if I remember correctly, somebody said that we're taking oil from Alaska and we're selling it to the Japanese and to the Chinese. I'm not sure if that's going on anymore. But I think there's something going on, and I want to just remark also that the cost of compressing natural gas and shipping it by freighter makes it very inefficient and going to be very expensive. Now, the next thing that I really have not heard anybody talking about in this business is the quality of life of the human beings all over the world being fed, being relatively disease-free. Something is going on there. Now, I honestly look at our government, and I look at it as the most malevolent bunch of expletive deleted people, and the capitalists who are cooperating with them, the large companies, also fall under that pale. So I'm really surprised that something hasn't been done in the public relations field for reducing the population of the Earth gradually.
Can we get a question, a clear question on this? What do you want to know? What do you want to ask about?
I'm thinking that there's something else going on here. And I just wonder if you guys have gotten anything. For instance, I look at this the AIDS epidemic or pandemic that's going on in Africa and the uncivilized, I don't like to use the word uncivilized because they are.
Well, do you want, let's talk about, you have some questions about natural gas and LNG and oil to China. Let's see if Stuart has any comments about that. Thanks for your call.
Yeah, so the natural gas piece is, natural gas production in the United States peaked in, from memory, 1981. In the late 70s, there were a lot of problems with natural gas. There was a time where, you know, we had to sort of have a lot of schools shut down and so forth because we didn't have the natural gas, and that led to a lot of fuel switching away from natural gas, and demand dropped a lot. We rediscovered it on a large scale in the 90s and did some deregulation and then started using it a lot for electricity generation again. And now we've run into this situation where we really have a significant natural gas problem in North America. And basically, the annual decline in natural gas production is 31%. So if you take this, so I should be careful. If you take a well, a new well this year, we'll be producing 31% less next year than it is this year. So it, the production declines are really dramatic because basically we're going and finding little pockets and natural gas in very tight places, very tight rocks where the natural gas flows very poorly through the rock. And so, you know, something, the natural gas that we need to keep production, domestic production level in 2012, only half of it has been discovered at this point. So we're rushing around frantically. There's been a huge explosion in the number of rigs looking for natural gas in North America. And we're, you know, busy doing everything we can, running faster and faster on the treadmill, trying to stay in the same place, and not quite making it. You know, production, total production has been declining at sort of 1% to 2% a year in the last few years, whereas demand keeps wanting to go up because, you know, right at the time when we were hitting this situation, we decided to put a bunch of new electricity generation in powered by natural gas because it's cleaner. So, that, I mean, there was a motivation. And so what we're trying to do to address the shortfall is people are trying to bring in all this liquefied natural gas. Which, as the gentleman points out, has inefficiencies. There's about a 15% loss when you liquefy natural gas and then regasify it on the other side. And so, but there are places in the world that still have a lot of natural gas, and it's probably a relatively short thing to do, short-term thing to do, because peak natural gas is probably not too far out. But you know, that's what we're doing in the short term to try and address our natural gas shortfall. And of course, it's unpopular because nobody wants to live near the natural gas terminals. So.
All right, let's take another short question here. Hi, you're on the air.
Thank you. Yeah, I have to say I'm amazed for all the confusion of the last man's questions that you managed to skirt around entirely what he was talking about repeatedly, which was population. I you know, the increase in human population is one of the major factors in why all the rest of this stuff gets so urgent. And I think population is something we need to look at in a little more honest way.
Well, maybe we can have a whole program devoted to that. I'd be happy to. I've actually, my doctorate's in...
story from oil depletion, though.
Yeah.
It's the same story.
Yeah, my doctorate's actually in population biology, so this is dear to my heart. Stuart, do you want to say anything?
How many people can just pretend it isn't happening and go on and talk about everything as if there isn't a difference between the 1940 population and the 2000 population.
Well, there is a reason for increased demand that has both to do with consumption and population.
Both, certainly,
yeah, so.
But we shouldn't ignore population.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, and I certainly didn't mean to. I just, you know, the gentleman made a number of points, and I just picked on the first one that stood in my mind. But you're absolutely right. I mean, the fundamental driver of why we're using more and more resources every year, well, there's two fundamental drivers. One is we keep trying to be more and more affluent every year, but the other is to keep being more and more of us every year. And now, you know, the UN says that population is going to stabilize at 9 or 10 billion, I believe, in towards the middle of this century.
Ouch.
And that assumption depends on the idea that all the developing countries will go through what's called the demographic transition. Mm-hmm. The idea is that, you know, when countries get more affluent or something, it's not quite clear what causes demographic transition.
Well, my understanding is that the key to demographic transition is that women be educated and offered employment so they can support themselves.
That is
so they are not dependent on men, and that is when the population goes down significantly.
Well, we're going to have to...
That's
a really big... I have some ideas for another show related to this, but I think we have to end it for there, and I need to thank my guests and thank my callers, and... thank the members of KZOX for sponsoring the show, and also Grace is on Maine. located at 323 North Main Street in Ukiah, open 7 days a week in December, and Black Bear Press, printers on the Mendocino Coast. Stuart, it was a great pleasure to talk to you, and I hope that people tune in to your posts on theoildrum.com. Thanks a lot, Stuart.
Thanks for having me.
All right.
And that does it for this morning's edition of The Party's Over. Thank you very much, Jason, for a wonderful show. And thanks to Tim for doing the engineering. Coming up.